Okay, so I think we're right on time. So I'm really excited when I was asked to chair this session, and I think for those of you that were in this room yesterday listening to Diane and John talk about drawdown for retirees, I think we're looking at it from some of the technical aspects and challenges. Today we're going to look at using digital capabilities to create a personalized retirement journey. And so I think in terms of timeliness, given all that's going on with Treasury, notwithstanding all the demographic shifts in the industry, I think it's a good sort of time to look at this challenge again. I should say, sorry, my name's Wade Madison, so I lead Milliman in Australia, and I've been asked to make sure that you provide all your feedback via the app. And we'll have hopefully some time for questions, so start to give some thought to questions as you work your way through, and we'll make sure that we take them from the microphone. In terms of the presenters today, really pleased to introduce Deb Ralston and Jeremy Duffield. So I'll try and keep the introductions brief and get onto the content, but Deborah hopefully is well known to many of you. You'll notice she's got a bit of a croaky voice, so she ensures me that she didn't have a big night at the cocktail party last night and that it's a cold, but you're not too sure with these researchers that, But anyway, they let their hair down after night. But I think, but Deb's been obviously deeply involved in the Retirement Covenant work, is chairing the SMSF Association, and is here in the capacity of the work she's doing for the Australian Centre for Financial Studies. So I think really pleased to have her able to, discuss this topic today. And she's accompanied by Jeremy Duffield. So again, hopefully, most of you might be familiar with Jeremy. So Jeremy was actually responsible for getting Vanguard up and running in the Australian market many, many years ago. But for the last number of years has devoted his time and energy to trying to help organisations solve this retirement income challenge through using more modern, digital techniques and algorithms and information. And so Jeremy's here in his capacity as a founder of SuperEd, which is, fintech. He'll probably, maybe not a new up and starting sort of fintech. They've been around for a number of years, so I think it'll be fascinating just to see the lessons that Jeremy's learned in the number of years they've been working on these challenges. So without further ado, I'll hand it over and look forward to the session.
It is a great pleasure to be here talking to you today, and especially sharing this with Jeremy, who we've been involved in superannuation research for some years, and it's been a lot of fun to put this presentation together. We're going to talk about this fantastic digital tool, which I think is a really good solution to some of the retirement problems that funds are going to face in the short term with the SIPA and so forth. And it's really necessary to take a look first from the consumer's point of view about just what a difficult process this is. And as we all know, superannuation has been around for about 25 years and we're halfway to maturity. So far, we've been very focused on the accumulation phase. And funds are really ill-prepared for the wave of baby boomers who are moving into retirement. There are around 700 people a day retiring in Australia. And the decision to retire is really complex. With ever-increasing life expectancy, a lot of people have worries about running out of money and the decisions that are required of them at this point. Particularly in a DC system where you have concerns not only about running out of money and longevity risk for living too long, you can only say that as an actuaries conference, can't you? I always love it when actuaries say there's really bad news, you're going to live a long time. There's also inflation and investment risk, which is of real concern. So for the retiree, these are the kinds of decisions they're going to have to make. And most retirees, as you will know, are not particularly a literate group of people. So will you be eligible for the age pension? How much will I need to live on? How long will it last? You can see all of those questions there. It's a really complicated set of questions. And most retirees are not advised, and they tend to stumble through this set of questions, always worrying if they've made the right choices. And it can certainly create a lot of anxiety. So this data is from some work I've been doing with Australian Super on a retirement confidence index. And we looked at 1,500 older people over 50, and half had retired, half hadn't retired. We were really comparing the attitudes of people. But overall, 38% were saying that they had great anxiety about retirement, 40% didn't have a retirement plan, and 24% were pretty sure that they hadn't saved enough money for their retirement.
So real focus that we're seeing both on number of tasks.
The outcome of all of that tends to be in the incredible thrift and frugality that people display in their spending. And in many ways, one would have to conclude that they're self-insuring. I actually got a few figures here from Wade's work with Milliman. And you can see there that it's quite extraordinary. The median spend of a single retiree, 65 to 69, is $24,000. Not much different to the single age pension. And the median spend of a couple, 65 to 69, is a bit higher at $35,000. It varies a lot geographically. If you go to some swish suburbs like South Yarra, Toorak, or Cottesloe in WA, or North Shore in Sydney, you might find people spend as a couple as much as $56,000 on average. But in poorer suburbs like Blacktown in New South Wales or Caboolture in Queensland, the spend is more like $26,000, $27,000. People are living very frugally. And the irony of all that, for those who do have super, as you can see from a Treasury discussion paper on the super, people invariably end up with 30% balance at the time they die. So they're not living well, and they're very fearful of running out of funds. And this indeed was the motivation for the Financial System Inquiry and its recommendation 11 that came through in 2014, that trustees should look to provide some kind of comprehensive income product for members that would have the ability to offer a fairly constant level of income and a better level of income than what they might receive from the minimum drawdown on an account-based pension, some flexibility to dip into capital needs from time to time, and also ability to manage some of the longevity risk, inflation risk, and investment risk that had been of key concern. So it's taken a while for this to move to the next stage, but one of the impediments, as you'd be aware, is in developing the legislation around longevity products, which has only just been finalised. And indeed, as Wade mentioned in the beginning, just this last week, the draft discussion paper is out on the retirement covenant, which is proposed to go into the SIS Act to guide trustees on this whole issue of how they might assist their members to work their way through these retirement decisions and to find an appropriate product to help them through in this period of retirement, hopefully with a bit less anxiety and with a higher standard of living than they've been enjoying so far. And originally, in the discussion paper that came out in 2016 to talk about the SIPA, it was envisaged that each fund would have pretty much one particular product that might hopefully suit members. But as you begin to look more and more at people in retirement, they are an incredibly diverse group. And they're diverse on a number of different dimensions. And the first dimension that's particularly important if you're thinking about creating a product based around a portfolio is whether or not they're eligible for the age pension. And as you can see on this slide, 30% of retirees are self-funding, 42% are on the full age pension, and 28% are on a part pension. This matters because if you have a high component of fixed interest in your future income flows, that's a very different kind of portfolio than someone who doesn't. So we know that the net present value of the age pension for a single individual is up above $500,000. And that's something to factor into how you might create an appropriate SIPA for each different segment of your market. If you don't take that into account, very difficult to define what is an appropriate product for each person. And diversity goes beyond that. There is the issue of the age pension, but it's also to do with household structure. And these days about 74% of people are living as a couple when they retire. And maybe somewhat surprisingly, 21% of those households have other individuals living there as well. They might be dependents or elderly parents or whatever. So you're not thinking about an individual in isolation. And particularly where you have a couple where one might have a concern about departing early and leaving the other one not looked after, the issue of a reversionary interest if they jointly retire and decide on a combined annuity of some kind is a really quite a big issue. And the behavioural research into this shows that it's really important for people to take that into consideration. In dollar terms, it may not be a real lot, technically speaking, but the comfort of knowing that that money will flow through to the surviving spouse is quite a big thing in people's thinking. In terms of home ownership, about 87% own their own home. You can see that these days around about 10% have a mortgage, which has to be acquitted before people can think about investing their funds into a retirement product. But each year we see the number who are retiring with a mortgage is increasing. So that's becoming more and more of an issue. And, of course, outside of that 87% of homeowners, you have people who are renting. I think it's something like 12% of people are renting at this stage of their life. That's very significant when you're planning retirement income because if that person's on an age pension, the living allowance for a single person on an age pension is around $3,600 per annum, which is around $70 a week, which leaves people who are renting in a very difficult position. So that has to be factored into the income flow that's necessary for a good life. There are other factors, and of course, funds will tend to know the super balance at retirement. They won't know about income expectations, and they vary. Some people live far more frugally than others. Life expectancy is important. Degree of risk aversion can come into account. And of course, the income that they have outside of superannuation is particularly important and has a big bearing, of course, on age pension eligibility. Now, trustees aren't going to know all this information. They're going to know the balance, they're going to know income, they're going to know age, and that's about it. So the challenge for coming to terms with how you can guide people through to retirement and give them a good outcome is quite a big challenge. As this slide says, very limited information. There is a standardised product can have the components that are required in a SIPA, some component of account-based pension, some component of longevity insurance, and the percentages can just be varied to suit individuals. But you can also look at segmenting the demographics of a fund and thinking about products that might suit different groups. For example, a single non-homeowner on a full-age pension with a low super balance would tend to have a very different standard product to a married homeowner with a part pension and medium super balance and other assets. So, ultimately, if you could engage with your members throughout and get to know them better, it'd be so much easier to guide them to a really appropriate solution. But there are going to be stages in this, from a standardised product to a segmented product to a more customised product. And probably to start with, for a lot of funds, coming up with a standardised product will be their key concern. And of course, I'll say that later. So, just for example, let's look at these members of the super fund, and they're very different. You've got Susan, she's single, full-age pension, good health, homeowner, likely to live a long time, pretty modest super balance, and she's going to... Well, actually, she doesn't need to rent because we've said she's a homeowner. We're supposed to say she's a non-homeowner. But that would need to be taken into account, a reliable income flow that would cover all of her needs. And then you've got Joan and Mark, who are doing a little better off. They're retiring as a couple, part-age pensioners. They are homeowners. They're in good health. They have some assets outside of super. They have two adult children. They're looking pretty healthy, but in all likelihood, one will go before the other. That might make them prefer a reversionary benefit in their joint annuity. And they'd like to leave a small bequest to their children. That's pretty high expectations with that amount of money. And I should say, not everybody will be suitable for a SIPA. People can opt out, and funds can also choose not to make that offer on various grounds. But particularly if people have life-threatening illnesses, there's hardly any point going into a longevity product. They're quite wealthy, they might just prefer to self-insure. Or if they've got a very low balance and the discussion paper says, say, below 50,000, it's hardly worth thinking about these things. So looking at, from the fund's point of view, you might look at some members. You might look at Susan at 150, Joan at 250 in her super, and I think that's Jux. I'm not too happy about Jux, actually. On 150 and think, well, they're all pretty similar. You'd think some kind of product would suit them reasonably well. But when you start to get down and to know a bit more about them, they turn out to be really quite different. The couple, Joan and Mark, have 250 non-super wealth. Susan's eligible for the full pension. Joan and Mark are eligible for a part pension. And poor old Jacques, who's a bit of a sad story on this slide, I've got to tell you, is not eligible for a pension. He hasn't met the residency test. And if you factor in the effective starting balance, including the net present value of the age pension plus the funds they have to invest, when you take them both into account, You can see that Susan has 650,000. You can see that Joan and Mark have a bit over a million by the time you take the net present value of their joint and age pension and their savings into account. So if you assume that their super is invested, say, 70-30, and then you add in the SIPA, and in this case, the SIPA is 25% annuity and 75% balanced portfolio, you end up with these allocations. And Susan has 12% growth and 88% fixed interest. Joan and Mark will have 28% growth and 72% fixed interest. And Jacques will have 54% growth and 46% fixed interest. So as you can see, the income and the volatility and so on will be quite different. But you can see just on the bottom there that Susan might expect an income around 30,000, which is, you know, a 25-30% increase over the age pension. So that's quite a nice outcome for there. Joan, as an individual, will be entitled to 30 to 32,000, and of course Mark will also have the same amount as that. And poor Jacques, in the end, I said he was a bit sad. He's going to get 9,300. Now, I've tried to think about what his life might be. I think he might have come in on a family migrant visa. He might be living with his family. He's one of those 21%. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to afford his house, would he? So that's why I think his story is. As you go through, you can see that in terms of the trade-offs that have to be made here, in terms of their effective fixed income allocation, the expected annual income, stability of income, investment risk volatility, longevity income protection, and the likelihood of leaving a bequest, which is pretty low all around for these individuals, they're quite different. Each person has quite a different set of criteria that they want to look at. So the problem for trustees is how to find something that suits people without a huge amount of need for advice. And Jeremy's going to talk to you a little bit more about that and his model for digital intrafund advice. And I think the really important thing about this is that these tools can help with engagement from the beginning of a person enrolling with a super fund. And engagement means not only can you guide and inform people better along the way, but ultimately you will retain them later into life. And of course, people don't just retire and stop evolving. Things continue to change. And continuing that engagement and accommodating people's needs is really important. So I'm going to hand over to Jeremy now, who's going to talk to you about the tool called SuperEd.
Thanks, Ed. Actually, I'm not going to talk to you about SuperEd per se, but really a generic version of how a fund can develop a digital means to help members get to the right outcome. I think the crucial thing from Deb's presentation, which I totally agree with, is that we're all different in retirement. I always like to say we're the most different when we're retired. We actually accentuate our differences, and we really need to appreciate that. And you worry about a system like a SIPR, which might be designed for standardization. So the question is, how can we move something that seeks to take advantage of default capabilities, but yet make it more personalized and help someone get to the right outcome for them? So I was really impressed by the Retirement Income Covenant paper when it talked about engagement being the second principle. And Darren Kennedy put it yesterday that all trustees need to provide the help and guidance to members to help them get the right retirement income solution, the right one for them that meets their needs. And the basic point in the presentation I'm making today is that digital tools can really help that in Superfund space. So I'm looking at this from the Superfund's perspective. What should they do to help their members get the right outcome in retirement? And so we look at it first and foremost as creating a customer journey, creating a journey from the beginning when they start with the fund, but I'm really focusing on pre-retirees and beyond. So think of it as 50 plus. And the best funds out there are working hard on their customer journeys. They're designing step-by-step approaches to these big questions that people face at different phases of their life. You know, starting off with where am I heading? What can I do? Can I then at near retirement? Can I retire? What should I do? What help will I need? Then the various challenges they meet at retirement. How will I get the retirement income I need? Should I get personal advice? And then after retirement, you know, we're not dead, and there are things that we still need help with. It's still a journey. And along the way, when we get to retirement, we may need help with the age pension, because that's, as the retirement income covenant paper reminds us, it's an extremely important part of the whole equation. So maybe we need to help members with the age pension as well. So let's take a look at the stages. And we start off with a dumb cluck called Jeremy. And he has his first question in his pre-retirement stage as, you know, where am I heading? So perhaps the first point is to give him a retirement income forecast. And the retirement income paper also talks about this, that retirement income forecast should get more focus. We should give people an idea of where they're heading, what direction they're in, and then work out what they can do about it. And we like to think about it by giving them a stochastic forecast so they can see a range of outcomes, because the real world we live in has a range of outcomes. It doesn't have a single outcome as much as like we'd like to pretend it does. And I think by the time you're 50, you've grown up enough to be able to recognize that there is actually a range of outcomes with good and bad markets. So this starts to engage Jeremy in a conversation. Adult learning is about engaging people to solve their own problems. And this is the thesis behind this. We're creating a trigger to get Jeremy engaged. And if I saw that forecast, that's my income forecast, I'd say, that's not enough. What can I do about it? So then you show them, well, Jeremy, these are the things you can do about it. You can think about what your goal in retirement is. You can use some of Wade's analysis on spending data to work out how much I'm going to need to spend at my minimum level. And then if I want to have a desired income, what would, with discretionary items, what would cover that? So as many calculators do, we present a series of sliders or things that people can do and engage them to understand what they can do to get ready now for retirement. It's critical in those 50s period to really make the last, it's your last chance to start getting ready for retirement. You've got to address contributions and let them see what the implications of doing that are. Move on to the near retirement stage, and here Acme Superfund should be really starting to put the options that someone's going to have available to them on the table. So they should be getting into some income layering thinking. Where am I going to get my income from? When can I afford to retire? How long will my money last? And will I be eligible for the age pension? Are all critical questions Acme Superfund can help me with. And then let he or she know what the choices are. Acme Superfund allows you personal advice, which may be very helpful, or can encourage you to make your own decisions and help you with some of that by giving you better information, or it can point you to the My Retirement or SIPA default options. So in this pre-retirement stage, Acme Superfund ought to be letting the member know what the choices available to him are. At retirement stage, I'm still left in doubt as to what's going to be the trigger for retirement in the SIPA default situation. What is it going to be? Is it going to be an age milestone? Is it going to be a switch from accumulation to pension? I think the papers so far have been pretty unclear about what the trigger that brings about the default is going to be. But I think that's an interesting thing for a super fund to think about. When do we start to trigger this conversation? Hopefully by now we've collected a lot of information so we know when the member is thinking about retirement and we're starting to get ready, and we're sending the messages that when you're ready, we're here to help you. Don't forget us. Don't go talk to one of those financial planners on the streets. We're here to help you. And the fund springs into action, either with personal advice that could either be digital or human, or confirmation of their desire to get a default solution. And definitely needs to seek more information about the member. And that should be, we think, through something like this My Retirement Wizard. We've got to know the information that we have to have to help somebody get the right choice. And so I foresee funds collecting this information to make sure that the member gets the right SIPA choice for them. And it can be a pretty simple set of data. It's basic, we do it as basic English language questions to let someone fill it out and tell their own story. But given that SIPAs are going to have to be consented to under the retirement income covenant, you know, having this sort of basic wizard to help people get to the right outcome is an elementary thing for super funds to do. I'd say a must do. And then you think, well, what's the decision tree? All funds will come up with their own decision tree. This is the one Deb and put into her submission in the first SIPA consultation paper, and I really like this. First of all, they've got to complete the wizard. If you don't know enough about the individual to make sure they're in the right SIPA, they shouldn't be entitled to a SIPA. And so they should triage out to personal advice, which could be digital or human. Then they ought to meet a bunch of simple criteria. Do they have debt? Are they in good health? Do they have substantial assets outside super? And again, based on that, they should be either go right to super or triage out to a different type of advice strategy. If they still meet the super criteria, then, as Deb indicated, whether they're in a single or a couple's relationship is really important. And then, because we need to work out what their estimated age pension is. And then based upon what their age pension is, we might design the SIPA solutions after that. So basically, I see funds developing their own decision trees in this sort of mode in the next year or so. Then we think that the age pension needs to be incorporated throughout the whole process. And it's open to funds to decide they should help the members with getting the age pension. The age pension is actually a nightmare for people to actually go through the process of dealing with Centrelink, and they actually describe that. They'll say it's a nightmare going through that process, and they need help. And so there are services out there that develop that, and one is Retirement Essentials, which was developed with on the SuperEd platform, but that helps members get the age pension. And we think that's very important for super funds to think about helping members with the age pension. And then someone gets through their retirement stage, and now they're in retirement. And we need to communicate the SIPA default to them. And we're going to have to do that well. And again, we think digital can help with that very well. In the beta group analysis that the Treasury sponsored, they did some very good work on what are good forms of communications to help members make the right decision about SIPAs. And we think charts will help as well. And again, all of that can be done very effectively through digital means. In the post-retirement stage, people continue to need help. We're not dead yet. And actually, if you think about the lifespan of the average person in retirement, there's going to be a tremendous amount that changes in their circumstances. So I think the idea of a SIPA as a set and forget is a pretty naive idea. People are going to change and going to need modifications to their own retirement income solutions. And we're going to need ongoing communications to help them work out whether they're still on track or whether they need to make a change. So I think we have the opportunities to help them with other needs that will emerge, like aged care, estate issues. And then I think over time, the proportion of income from the age pension will increase as assets are depleted. So again, the messages change. So really wrapping up, this era of helping people through their retirement requires the focus on a journey to get people to a personalized solution that meets their needs. We think digital is a huge part of the solution because it's the way to get advice out to more people at lower cost, and it's actually much more rich in terms of what it can do than traditional means. So it'll be a very important complement to traditional human forms of advice. Not a replacement, but an and strategy. Digital and human will move people forward to better retirement outcomes. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, guys. So we've got about, I think, 10 minutes or so. So I can see a few of you on the edge of your seats waiting to come up and ask a question. So if you've got a question, please make your way to the microphone and just introduce yourself and then we'll go from there.
All right. Daniel Levy here. It's a very good presentation. Thank you. Do you have any views about the personal advice regime and how that impacts on the types of conversations that are required here?
So the personal advice regime is, you know, a critical issue, and one of the critical issues in the whole SIPA consultation is what carve-outs there are for trustees. As you know, there is no distinction between digital advice and human advice as far as what personal advice is required, when personal advice is required to be given and demonstrated by a statement of advice. So it's going to be an ongoing issue to discuss with ASIC, and many trustees are wrestling with this question of what's the difference between help and personal advice. And funds that we talk to want to provide help, and they want to break out of the bounds of this general advice and personal advice distinction, which they think is tying them up in knots and not helping them engage with consumers the way they think they want to be engaged with. So there's a lot of work to be done on definitions of personal advice. I think we can work with them in them as they are, but they're far from optimal.
Good answer.
Michael Monaghan. Firstly, great presentation on both sides. Thank you. And possibly more of a comment in a way, but I think the issue of personal advice is personal advice. And actually, there's no question about it. It is personal advice and therefore has to be dealt with. In fact, a lot of general advice is really personal advice. So the issue is, I think, that as you've said, Jeremy, there shouldn't be no distinction between whether it's delivered digitally or in person or some other way. It still has to be done properly. And that's the thing, I suppose, that my question is a SIPA-type regime, in effect, personal advice provided by the fund, and therefore can it work in the way that it's supposedly designed, or will it always require some kind of tool like a digital tool or a combination of a digital and face-to-face advice? And particularly in the situation, as you pointed out, Jeremy, where people's circumstances change dramatically after retirement. I agree with you, it's actually a very diverse time in terms of people's different needs and opportunities and so forth. And even the concept of what is retirement is a very difficult thing to answer. Just interested in your comments on that.
Yeah, lots of food for thought there. I think the government will have a difficult issue to deal with in deciding what the safe harbour provisions are for SIPA. And I almost think there's a rush to simplify it and override some of the real considerations. I did a list on the plane coming up of how many error types there are in getting an unsuitable SIPA to somebody out there. In 10 minutes on the plane, I came up with 11 error types. So the government starts out with trying to deal with the error of people underspending and dying with a bunch of money at death, so leaving a legacy. But that's only one error type. I can think of, for every SIPA and various different people, I can think of different error types that will arise from those circumstances. And is it okay to just blithely assume they don't exist? or may exist, and sort of the safe harbor provisions go to that. That's why we think that funds will have a SIPA solution that will be essentially a flagship benchmark, and then personalized solutions will be created against those, and someone will be able to compare the benchmark solution to a more personally tailored solution that the fund might help them get to. So that's how I think it will emerge. I think funds will want to have a default solution, but encourage people to get help, to get a personalised and correct solution for them.
I think the concept has been a SIPA without advice, a standardised product, which would have the advantages of a higher income than you'd get on a minimum drawdown ABP with that longevity protection in, whether it's a deferred annuity or whatever. And a standardised product without personalised advice. But the safe harbour would have to be pretty tight for trustees because they won't know all of the facts. It's a really tricky area, yeah.
I guess just further, I'm Melinda House from BT, just further to that one, you know, I'm thinking about how we've got all the building blocks of all the different types of products you'd need to put a SIPA together, but we've sort of been holding off on doing anything until we really, you know, until we sort of see how it all emerges, and I guess we're starting to get more of a sense of that now. But I think the challenge, just listening to Peter Kell's talk this morning as well about the design and distribution obligations and how does that sit with this, because I have to, as a trustee and a product provider, ensure that the SIPA I'm designing is suitable for the customer segment. Now, as you've just very clearly pointed out, there's multiple and very different customer segments in this space. So how are those two going to sit together is a very interesting question. And I guess the other one as well, we're developing a lot of offers now direct to customer in the super and we want to do that in the retirement space as well. And I guess my question then to the panel is, so we can provide help and guidance, but it has been the case that that a retiree really wants to go and talk to someone in a bit of detail before they lock themselves into these products. They're complex, they don't understand them. And I'd love to think we can get to a situation where we can actually guide someone through a guided customer journey where they don't need to do that. But do you think people will still want that reassurance of sitting down and chatting to someone? Because that's certainly been the behaviour today.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. And I think it's kind of three parts to that. There's information, there's guidance and advice. And I think over time, people will be getting information all the way through their super journey and the guidance will be so much more simple at the end. But I've never seen an important decision where people don't want that face-to-face validation at the same time. But if you use the tools right, that needs to be a much more cost-effective, easier thing to do than to sit down and work through everything from the beginning in the full advice picture. Yeah,
I think hybrid solutions are going to be very, very important. So, you know, having someone do it online or fill in the wizard online and then talk it through with somebody on the phone. But they can always do it digitally if they want. And over time, they'll get more comfortable with the digital solutions. Digital solutions will be richer. They just won't have the human voice giving them the assurance, and that so far has proved to be very important. But hybrid models are taking off and deserve a lot of attention, I think.
I think the whole problem is really difficult. It's a really difficult problem, and it's a huge step for funds who have not tended to engage with their members, have very limited information. It's a big problem, and it's going to take a lot of good thinking. But despite all of that, you've got people out there who are really anxious and not sure about their future. So it's a problem that we kind of have to crack in a way. And I think for most of us who have good jobs, white-collar workers, good amount of super, it's very hard to kind of understand the amount of anxiety and consternation that is out there amongst people. So we have to always kind of keep that in mind, I think.
I'd also just like to take on the point about how long it's taking. I mean, based on the current schedule that was laid out, it's going to be 4 years since the SIPA paper was laid out initially. 4 years to get something going when 250,000 people are retiring every year, that's a huge waste of opportunity for the industry and for Australia. So I would encourage funds to get on with it, because the government is starting to set out the framework, and I think we can see where it's going, and I don't think it would be too difficult to modify to meet the actual requirements of SIPA. So I think all funds should be getting on with it and getting into designing retirement income solutions that then they can then adapt to the SIPA requirements. But get on with it. I mean, we've got 700 people retiring a day.
I know, but the benefit of that, of course, is that if you've got engagement, you're going to have better retention in the longer run.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the upside of having to come to grips with a lot of this. Are you going to say something?
No, it's been going great so far. It's the easiest chairing session ever. I think just... Sorry? I was a bit... Well, I actually do... Yeah, I do have one question for you, however. Like, I think, you know, we talk about funds and we've discussed it on phone calls about the amount of time it's taken for funds to start to navigate this retirement income challenge. And I guess my question, if you look at kind of what they're doing, and there is activity taking place, you know, robo-advice is sort of the immediate one that we see where funds are trying to figure out how they scale up to give that advice. I guess my question is, you know, do you think they're doing enough to actually engage and provide people with the information they need even before it gets to that robo-advice sort of behind a paywall type environment? And how do you see it kind of syncing up that information plus then execution at the back end?
Well, you know, a lot of funds don't even have the emails for their members, so we're starting from a tough spot.
Yeah, I think it's an industry dynamic. I think the industry's got to get moving. You know, it's a very, in a sense, satisfied industry because it sits on so much money, so much capital that keeps coming in, although, you know, what, 40% of funds have net outflows now, and I would think we have a burning platform to get going. You know, many funds are losing 90% of their members at retirement. I think we have a burning platform, and I think my old boss at Vanguard used to say, we can afford to be confident, but we can't afford to be complacent. And there's too much complacency in our industry, to put it impolitely, I guess.
Yeah, and I think a tremendous underestimation of the amount of trust that members have in their funds. That's come through on that research I was talking about on the retirement confidence thing. People really trust their funds to help them through this process. And I guess when they don't get that help, they just get frustrated and go their own way.
Yeah, quick. I'm getting the wind up from the back of the room. Shoot away. Yeah.
Just a very quick one. One of the outcomes of the Royal Commission in relation to advice could be elimination of vertical integration. What would be the ramifications for that, particularly given issues like the trust that people have in their fund and so forth, if funds were not permitted to give advice?
Personally, I think vertical integration, well done, is perfectly defensible and a good thing for the industry. So I'm going to stick up for vertical integration. It just needs to be well done. And I think super funds are a case in point. Super funds should be providing advice to their members because they can do it on a cost-efficient basis. As Deb says, they're trusted. We've just got to have the safeguards in place to make sure it is well done in a way that protects consumers. I would be shocked and disappointed if vertical integration per se was outlawed, because I think it's going to present some of the best solutions in the industry.
It's going to depend a lot on the definition of intra-fund advice and what's expected for that too, isn't it?
All right, well, now we're over time, but, you know, please thank me. Thank Jeremy and Deborah. I think it was a fascinating conversation.